Chapter 3. Men's Lives. Do you see where the kernel of the matter lies? A man cannot be comfortable without his own approval. He will secure the largest share possible of that, at all costs, all sacrifices. Why? A minute ago you said Hamilton fought that duel to get public approval. I did. By refusing to fight the duel he would have secured his family's approval, and a large share of his own. But the public approval was more valuable in his eyes than all other approvals put together in the ether above it. To secure that would furnish him the most comfort of mind, the most self-approval, so he sacrificed all other values to get it. Why? Some noble souls have refused to fight duels, and have manfully braved the public contempt. They acted according to their make. They valued their principles and the approval of their families above the public approval. They took the thing they valued most, and let the rest go. They took what would give them the largest share of personal contentment, and approval a man always does. Public opinion cannot force that kind of men to go to the wars. When they go it is for other reasons. Other spirit-contenting reasons. Why? Always spirit-contenting reasons? There are no others. Why? When a man sacrifices his life to save a little child from a burning building, what do you call that? When he does it, it is the law of his make. He can't bear to see the child in that peril a man of a different make could, and so he tries to save the child, and loses his life. But he has got what he was after, his own approval. Why? What do you call love, hate, charity, revenge, humanity, magnanimity, forgiveness? Different results of the one master impulse. The necessity of securing one's self-approval. They wear diverse clothes, and are subject to diverse moods, but in whatsoever ways they masquerade they are the same person all the time. To change the figure, the compulsion that moves a man and there is but the one is the necessity of securing the contentment of his own spirit. When it stops, the man is dead. Why? That is foolishness. Love, why, love is that impulse, that law, in its most uncompromising form. It will squander life, and everything else on its object. Not primarily for the object's sake, but for its own. When its object is happy and that is what it is unconsciously after. Why? You do not even accept the lofty and gracious passion of mother love? No, it is the absolute slave of that law. The mother will go naked to clothe her child. She will starve, that it may have food. Suffer torture to save it from pain. Die that it may live. She takes a living pleasure in making these sacrifices. She does it for that reward, that self-approval, that contentment, that peace, that comfort. She would do it for your child, if she could get the same pay. Why? This is an infernal philosophy of yours. It isn't a philosophy, it is a fact. Why? Of course you must admit that there are some acts which, there is no act, large or small, fine or mean, which springs from any motive but the one, the necessity of appeasing and contenting one's own spirit. Why? The world's philanthropists, I honor them, I uncover my head to them from habit and training. And they could not know comfort or happiness or self-approval, if they did not work and spend for the unfortunate. It makes them happy to see others happy, and so with money and labor they buy what they are after, happiness, self-approval. Why don't miners do the same thing? Because they can get a thousandfold more happiness by not doing it. There is no other reason. They follow the law of their make. Why? What do you say of duty for duty's sake? That is, does not exist. Duties are not performed for duty's sake, but because their neglect would make the man uncomfortable. A man performs but one duty, the duty of contenting his spirit, the duty of making himself agreeable to himself. If he can most satisfyingly perform this sole and only duty by helping his neighbor, he will do it. If he can most satisfyingly perform it by swindling his neighbor, he will do it. But he always looks out for number one first. The effects upon others are a secondary matter. Men pretend to self-sacrifices, but this is a thing which, in the ordinary value of the phrase, does not exist and has not existed. A man often honestly thinks he is sacrificing himself merely and solely for someone else, but he is deceived. His bottom impulse is to content a requirement of his nature and training, and thus acquire peace for his soul. Why? Apparently, then, all men, both good and bad ones, devote their lives to contenting their consciences. Yes. That is a good enough name for it. Conscience, that independent sovereign, that insolent absolute monarch inside of a man who is the man's master. There are all kinds of consciences, because there are all kinds of men. You satisfy an assassin's conscience in one way, a philanthropist's in another, a miser's in another, a burglar's in still another. As a guide or incentive to any authoritatively prescribed line of morals or conduct, leaving training out of the account, a man's conscience is totally valueless. I know a kind-hearted Kentuckian whose self-approval was lacking, whose conscience was troubling him, to phrase it with exactness, because he had neglected to kill a certain man, a man whom he had never seen. The stranger had killed this man's friend in a fight. This man's Kentucky training made it a duty to kill the stranger for it. He neglected his duty, kept dodging it, shirking it, putting it off, and his unrelenting conscience kept persecuting him for this conduct. At last, to get ease of mind, comfort, self-approval, he hunted up the stranger and took his life. It was an immense act of self-sacrifice, as per the usual definition, for he did not want to do it, and he never would have done it if he could have bought a contented spirit and an unworried mind at smaller cost. But we are so made that we will pay anything for that contentment, even another man's life. Why? You spoke a moment ago of trained consciences. You mean that we are not born with consciences competent to guide us aright? If we were, children and savages would know right from wrong and not have to be taught it. Why? But consciences can be trained? Yes. Why? Of course, by parents, teachers, the pulpit, and books. Yes, they do their share. They do what they can. Why? And the rest is done by a million unnoticed influences, for good or bad. Influences which work without rest during every waking moment of a man's life, from cradle to grave. Why? You have tabulated these? Many of them, yes. Why? Will you read me the result? Another time, yes. It would take an hour. Why? A conscience can be trained to shun evil and prefer good? Yes. Why? But will it for spirit contenting reasons only? It can't be trained to do a thing for any other reason. The thing is impossible. Why? There must be a genuinely and utterly self-sacrificing act recorded in human history somewhere. You are young. You have many years before you. Search one out. Why? It does seem to me that, when a man sees a fellow being struggling in the water, and jumps in at the risk of his life to save him, wait. Describe the man. Describe the fellow being. State if there is an audience present, or if they are alone. Why? What of these things, to do with the splendid act? Very much. Shall we suppose, as a beginning, that the two are alone, in a solitary place, at midnight? Why? if you choose. O.M.M. And that the fellow being is the man's daughter? Y.M.M. Well, N.O. Make it someone else. O.M.M. A filthy drunken ruffian, then? Y.M.M. I see. Circumstances alter cases. I suppose that, if there was no audience to observe the act, the man wouldn't perform it. O.M.M. But there is here and there a man who would. People, for instance, like the man who lost his life trying to save the child from the fire, and the man who gave the needy old woman his 25 cents, and walked home in the storm. There are here and there men like that who would do it. And why? Because they couldn't bear to see a fellow being struggling in the water, and not jump in and help. It would give them pain. They would save the fellow being on that account. They wouldn't do it otherwise. They strictly obey the law which I have been insisting upon. You must remember, and always distinguish the people who can bear things from people who can. It will throw light upon a number of apparently elf-sacrificing cases. Why? M.M. Oh, dear, it's all so disgusting. Oh. M.M. Yes. And so true. Why? M.M. Come, take the good boy who does things he doesn't want to do, in order to gratify his mother. Oh. M.M. He does 7/10 of the act, because it gratifies him to gratify his mother. Throw the bulk of advantage the other way, and the good boy would not do the act. He must obey the iron law. None can escape it. Why? M.M. Well, take the case of a bad boy who, oh. M.M. You needn't mention it, it is a waste of time. It is no matter about the bad boy's act. Whatever it was, he had a spirit-contenting reason for it. Otherwise you have been misinformed, and he didn't do it. Why? M.M. It is very exasperating. A while ago you said that man's conscience is not a born judge of morals and conduct, but has to be taught and trained. Now I think a conscience can get drowsy and lazy, but I don't think it can go wrong, if you wake it up. A little story, O.M.M. I will tell you a little story. Once upon a time an infidel was guest in the house of a Christian widow whose little boy was ill, and near to death. The infidel often watched by the bedside, and entertained the boy with talk, and he used these opportunities to satisfy a strong longing in his nature, that desire which is in us all to better other people's condition by having them think as we think. He was successful. But the dying boy, in his last moments, reproached him and said, I believed, and was happy in it. You have taken my belief away, and my comfort. Now I have nothing left, and I die miserable, for the things which you have told me do not take the place of that which I have lost. And the mother, also, reproached the infidel, and said, My child is forever lost, and my heart is broken. How could you do this cruel thing? We have done you no harm, but only kindness. We made our house your home, you were welcome to all we had, and this is our reward. The heart of the infidel was filled with remorse for what he had done, and he said, It was wrong, I see it now, but I was only trying to do him good. In my view he was in error, it seemed my duty to teach him the truth. Then the mother said, I had taught him, all his little life, what I believed to be the truth, and in his believing faith both of us were happy. Now he is dead, and lost, and I am miserable. Our faith came down to us through centuries of believing ancestors. What right had you, or anyone, to disturb it? Where was your honor, where was your shame? Why? M.M. He was a miscreant, and deserved death. O.M.M. He thought so himself, and said so. Why? M.M. Ah, you see, his conscience was awakened. O.M.M. Yes, his self-disapproval was. It pained him to see the mother suffer. He was sorry he had done a thing which brought him pain. It did not occur to him to think of the mother when he was misteaching the boy, for he was absorbed in providing pleasure for himself then, providing it by satisfying what he believed to be a call of duty. Why? Call it what you please. It is to me a case of awakened conscience. That awakened conscience could never get itself into that species of trouble again. A cure like that is a permanent cure. Pardon, I had not finished the story. We are creatures of outside influences. We originate nothing within. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.